Welcome to the MTFN Bizcast, a podcast designed to provide information regarding a variety of legal topics. The attorneys at Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols host new episodes every month covering topics that are current and relevant to business owners, professionals, and members of the legal community. Although we cannot provide legal advice that you can rely on in these episodes, we do hope that they will be helpful to you if and when you ever do need to seek professional advice.
Hello, well, welcome to the MTFN Bizcast. My name is Alexander Lemke, and with me today is Randy Brotherhood. We're planning on talking a little bit about some basic trademark concepts that business owners should be aware of. Randy is a partner at our firm, and he's been doing this for quite a long time. And I recently joined Meisner Tierney from a larger firm in Milwaukee, and where I practiced in the intellectual property space. So, Randy, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
So, Randy, let's take a moment to kind of go through some of the highlights of intellectual property. I know we have patents, trademarks, copyrights, and trade secrets.
Right. Well, at a very high level, Alex, just to put it in perspective, our legal system overall provides certain rights and protections for owners of certain types of property that you and I and others call intellectual property, the fruits of mental labor, as opposed to the production of tangible things. And as you said, patents, copyrights, trademarks, and trade secret protection are the concepts, the primary regimes that constitute the area that we call intellectual property. The law of intellectual property functions on the premise that innovation really can't occur as a practical matter unless entrepreneurs and people who develop things and services and they succeed in the marketplace, they must be able to essentially recoup their costs, their research, and make a profit and be incentivized to go out there and create. And that same incentive also applies in the realm of tangible things, but it's very important with respect to intellectual property because unlike the manufacturer of a car or a trailer or a motorcycle where there's a title or lumber where it's transferred by a bill of sale, the only way that you can really secure rights to the fruits of your mental labor is through one of the intellectual property regimes, trademark.
Yeah, exactly. And so as like a smaller business owner or something like that, what kind of things are we looking at? So the way I always like to think of it is patents are, here's the thing that you made. Mm-hmm. And the thing to keep in mind about all of these is that they're exclusionary rights. They're just right. Like regular land property rights, and especially that's evident in the patent world where they talk about claims. Like, I'm sure everybody's heard of, oh, I can get a land claim or something like that. Well, patents also have claims that, right. And those claims allow you to exclude others from practicing that invention. It allows you to tell someone no when they want to practice it. Trade secrets are kind of that propriety information that you acquire. It'd be like customer lists, secret sauce. I think Coca-Cola, I think, has a trade secret for
right.
Its
recipe. Unlike some of the other intellectual property regimes, there's no filing or anywhere you go to submit your documentation to your trade secret. Rather, a trade secret is maintained by having your valuable proprietary information and maintaining it secret, maintaining it in confidence. And as long as you can maintain that trade secret in confidence, you
it'll last as long as you can keep it a secret.
Exactly.
So,
exactly. Trademarks and copyrights and patents are a little different in that regards. But you're right. To a large extent, what you're vying for when you try to obtain a patent, a copyright registration, or a trademark is, in a sense, almost a negative right, the right to exclude others from what you've created. And in some of these settings, patents, for instance, I believe you can only obtain a patent through a filing. That's not true yeah. with copyrights and trade secrets. It's certainly advantageous and advisable to register a copyright with the U.S. Copyright Office or register a trademark with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, but it's not needed in the trademark context, and I know that's what we're going to be focusing on here. Trademark rights are secured in the first instance by simply actually using your trademark and commerce. And I know I'm probably jumping ahead a little bit here. We should probably talk about what a trademark is. But for purposes of comparing the various intellectual property regimes, I think you've got it right. I mean, to a large extent, what you're doing is carving out a space that others can be excluded from.
Yeah, and I wanted to touch on your point that copyrights, also like trademarks, those are inherent. Those are just had by writing out something and meeting the elements of the copyright test. You don't have to register for those. Obviously, you can, and that gives you certain advantages.
Right.
And that's the same with the trademark. The trademark is gotten by using it.
That's
using
right.
Using it in commerce.
And we should probably talk about what the difference is, because when I work with clients on intellectual property matters, very often they confuse the difference between a copyright and a trademark. A copyright is essentially the exclusive right to use, distribute, copy, make derivative works from a literary or artistic work or another type of work of authorship, something that you've written or filmed in some type of a tangible medium. And all of these terms, you know, there's a lot of subjectivity about it. But it's essentially creating a work of authorship. A trademark, on the other hand, is essentially a symbol, a word. It can be a design. It can be even be a color and sometimes even a sound that's used to identify and distinguish a product or a service as to its source and distinguish it from the sources of other similar products.
Can we talk a little bit about the differences between trade names and trademarks for a second?
Sure. Well, sometimes they merge together and are one and the same. But by and large, a trade name is the name of a business, identifying the business itself, whereas a trademark identifies a product or service of a business. Trademarks are, as a general rule, not protectable. Trade names are not protectable as trademarks, as a general rule, although there are circumstances under which, as I say, they morph together. A good example would be, we're all familiar with the Kohler Company up in Kohler, Wisconsin, the maker of, you know, bath fixtures and that kind of a thing. And there, the name of the company is Kohler, but their name has become synonymous with their products. In fact, they affix their name to their products, so there it's used as a trademark. An example, a counterexample would be, for instance, Yum Foods. Not many people know what Yum Foods is, but they own numerous restaurant brands, including Taco Bell, KFC, that kind of a thing. Their Yum Brands is the trade name, but the commercial symbols, the trademarks that are registrable are
Colonel Sanders.
Exactly.
And the Taco Bell, I think they have the Taco Bell Ding is also trademarked.
Right. So it's important to keep, you know, a distinction, maintain a distinction and understanding between what a trade name is on the one hand and what a trademark is on the other. And the notion really is that the value, the commercial value that you're trying to secure and protect is really in what people identify as the product or the service.
So what are some of the things that, so when clients walk in the door and they're like, I have a business idea, and what do I need to be doing to protect that from just the trademark perspective?
Well, so the first thing
we'll talk about the patent part maybe at a different time,
right?
But the way to think about this is patents cover the thing that you made or the process of making that. Trademarks are more directed at your branding.
Yes.
And so what are the, so if you have a client that walks in the door saying, "Hey, I've got this great business idea, and I'm thinking of naming it this. Can I trademark this?"
And right.
They could pick any name in the world. So what are some of the things you would advise them to consider when picking a trademark?
Well, the first thing you do is you ask them what the mark is and what it denotes. That is to say, what is it intended to identify? For instance, if somebody comes to me and they say, I'm developing a new brand of ice cream, okay, and I want to call it Cold and Creamy Ice Cream, okay? What you and I would do is we'd sit down with them and say, okay, now we've got to talk to you about what a trademark is, number one, and how you protect it and the extent to which you can protect it. That takes you into the various classes of trademarks. For instance, what I've just described, if my client wants to offer a brand called Cold and Creamy Ice Cream, I'd say that's not really a good trademark from the standpoint of trademark law. It's what the law calls descriptive of the goods and services. Cold and Creamy Ice Cream describes the product.
Sticky tape or something like that.
Perfect example, right?
Kind of describes
and
what the product is.
Descriptive marks are generally not registrable, at least on the PTO, Patent and Trademark Office Principal Register. But and the theory there is that to the extent that they're descriptive, those terms are in a sense a string of generic terms to describe what the product is or does. And the notion is that the law does not permit people to take generic or descriptive words off the market, protectable as trademarks. So
another consideration is to consider when you have descriptive marks as well is even if you're able to get rights in something like that, mm-hmm. say if you had Cold and Creamy Ice Cream, but you had a very elaborate logo that went along with it, mm-hmm. your trademark rights are still going to be very narrow.
Right.
So you probably wouldn't be able to stop – you'd probably be able to stop someone from using your exact logo.
Right.
But you could probably – you'd probably have a tough time stopping someone from using Cold and Creamy Ice Cream if they just use it on plain font.
That's very true. And actually what you've described are two separate trademarks. A descriptive mark as a word mark could be very difficult to register, but if they have a very distinctive logo, that's a completely different story. Cold and Creamy within the context of a design that is registrable, and as we said earlier, both words and designs or symbols can be registered. Sure, the design might be very distinctive and capable of registration, but in terms of what you call your product, in terms of the words that connote it or denote it, that's what you've got to think about. And we always go through, as you know, a pretty careful analysis with a client before they decide on the name of their product to determine if it's how protectable it is. So we've just described a descriptive mark. And as you know, Alex, what we normally do is we lead the client toward what we call fanciful or arbitrary marks, it would be a mark that has nothing to do in terms of generic words or describing the good or the service. Pepsi is a perfect example for soda. You can come up with a whole bunch of
Apple,
them.
Apple. Exactly. Computers.
Well, and actually, that's a really interesting example because that's a generic term, but not for the product
exactly,
of computers.
Yeah. Exactly.
And there, a generic term would be perfectly appropriate because it doesn't describe the goods. So, yeah, that's different than an arbitrary or fanciful mark. But since it doesn't describe the good or the service, you would possibly get registration there.
Yeah. So one of the things when you walk into an attorney's office saying, hey, this is what I want to make, that's definitely a consideration you want is how much – the way to think of this is how much land can you cover with this one word?
Right.
If you pick something very descriptive – you may be able to stake out a little plot of land in the trademark
right.
world. But if you pick something more arbitrary or more fanciful, you can maybe get a little bit more piece of the pie.
And that's exactly right.
All goes into the value of that trademark. And particularly it comes into play when other people see how successful your product is or how successful your service is, and they want to get in on the action.
They want to emulate it. Right.
They want to get on
the
action.
Or imitate it. Right.
So if you – going back to the Cold and mm-hmm. Creamy example, if you have a very mm-hmm. successful – Cold and Creamy Ice Cream bars or something like that, you may have a tough time keeping someone who wants to create a creamy and fresh mark,
right.
something like
That's
that.
That's exactly right. So you're better off, and you've just described it. I mean, what we do as attorneys when clients come in is we try to guide them toward a trademark that provides them with the greatest amount of protection and the widest degree of ability to exclude others from getting too close to it. And the best way to do that would be with an arbitrary or fanciful mark or at least a non-descriptive and certainly not a generic mark. For instance, a generic mark, which is completely unregisterable, would be an example, ballpoint pen. If you're manufacturing pens and you try to trademark ballpoint pen, you'll get
Out of the office.
Exactly. Yeah. On the basis that those are generic terms and the patent and the law does not permit people to take generic terms off the market, if you will, by protecting them as trademarks.
Yeah, and that's the whole balance between innovation that we talked about earlier, the ability to innovate, bring new stuff to the marketplace,
right,
as well as balancing that between the competitiveness of it. So
right.
Obviously, ballpoint pen, that's not very innovative. It's what we call generic.
Right.
You shouldn't be able to have an exclusive right to that.
That's exactly right.
That balance that.
And that's how the law works.
Yep.
Right. So we try to move up the chain from certainly not generic to hopefully not descriptive to hopefully something that's arbitrary or what the law calls arbitrary or fanciful. And we can, you know, Nike shoes is a good example, you know, completely indistinguishable, different word. Nobody knows what it means. It doesn't have any descriptive operative effect in the English language other than to identify their product. That's usually considered to be the strongest type of trademark and the one that's accorded the greatest deal of protection under the law.
Yeah, and some of those trademarks, that it's a company's most valuable valuable property, some of that. Like the Nike mark, right. I think, is valued in the billions of dollars.
That's right. Just the word.
Exactly.
The trademark.
And the Nike swoosh,
same
that's
drill.
Worth billions of dollars on its own.
That's right. And see, that's really what I said when I said earlier about a commercial symbol used to identify. One of the major, and I'm going back to what we were talking about, the notion of intellectual property as, you know, protecting entrepreneurs and giving them rights to protect what they've developed in the way of mental labor. Think of the Nike name or the Nike swoosh. Those are registered trademarks, and those trademarks all by themselves are worth the kind of money you mentioned, wholly apart from whatever factories might be owned by Nike or inventory. Just that intellectual property has that value, and that's what trademark registration is designed to capture. It's a legal vehicle that captures that value, and it can be transferred, assigned, and trademarks are sold and transferred every day.
Yeah, very.
Sometimes for a lot of money.
A very timely example of that is Bed Bath & Beyond, actually. I believe I'm not so up to date on that, but I believe they went out of business. Mm-hmm. And they were bought up by another company. And I'm guessing the primary reason they were bought up was because of all their intellectual property.
Probably.
And the ability to use the Bed Bath & Beyond name on products that weren't made by Bed Bath & Beyond. But now that they own the trademarks for those.
They might be bankrupt. And they're, as you say, their balance sheet might show a beautiful asset in the that consists solely of a trademark registration. And that's transferable. You know, so that's what we try to capture for our clients when they come into us, you know, with a new product and a name. And what you're doing when you select a good trademark, you affix it to your goods and services, you start your business or you start whatever new product is that you're trying to develop, you register that trademark. And what you're doing each year is you're building up goodwill that actually shows up on the balance sheet for the company over time. Once they start having salespeople, the general public identifies that trademark with that company and that product, and that's where it becomes financially valuable.
Yeah, and the best time to get it right, obviously, is right at the beginning.
Absolutely.
That's where you want to try to capture as much as you can, and that's why it's so important to pick a good mark from the start. Because
right.
it's a lot harder to change it 5 or 6 years, 10 years, 20 years down the line.
Right.
When you've built up that goodwill.
Well, and that takes us to the procedure for obtaining trademark rights, because you asked about, what we do when a client comes in. Well, once the mark, you know, we consult about what the mark should be, then the question is, well, do they just start using it? And the answer really is no. Once a mark is selected, then the lawyer wants to undertake a suitable amount of due diligence to foreclose the possibility that there's somebody out there with the same or a substantially similar mark for those types of goods and services that might already be using it and therefore have prior rights.
Yeah, exactly.
Because the nightmare scenario is you start using a mark, you start making a whole bunch of money, and 10 years down the road, you get a cease and desist letter from somebody who started using the same mark for the same goods and services in a relatively same geographical market, but they started using it. They can prove they were using a mark first.
Exactly.
That's the nightmare scenario.
That nightmare scenario is most likely when you become successful.
Right.
Because that's when they're going to notice, hey,
exactly.
Wait a second, somebody else is using the same thing.
Right.
It's not when you're a mom and pop shop at the beginning. It's going to be after you've accrued all of that goodwill.
That's right. So then the question becomes, once, you know, you the client selects the mark and you conclude that it's registrable because it's fanciful, arbitrary, sufficiently distinctive of its goods and services to be capable of registration, then, you know, we lawyers will normally commission a search of that trademark. And there's a number of ways to do that. In fact, there's a bit of a process. The first is, you know, lawyers often do what they call a knockout search. They'll go on the internet. They'll go to the U.S. Patent Trademark Office website and search for to see if anybody is registered or applied to register or previously registered and allowed to get to become abandoned a registration of a mark that was similar.
Well, there's two things to keep in mind too. It's you also have to think of not just the word, but the goods and services that are involved.
That's right.
So I think
it's a subjective determination.
A big example right. here is Delta. So everyone has heard, I'm assuming most people have heard of Delta Faucets. Mm-hmm. And then there's also Delta Airlines, two completely right. different companies,
yep.
both very well-known trademarks. Mm-hmm. But just because you have chosen a word mark, for example, right. the fact that somebody else is already using it is not necessarily the end of the inquiry. The inquiry also has to conclude how are they using it.
That's
so
right.
if you want to use it, I think the Delta example kind of stands on its own, which is you have airplanes and faucets. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to confuse
that's right.
where those things are coming from.
Well, that's part of the process of the search. I mentioned the knockout search, which is just preliminary. I never allow a client to proceed in the normal course just on the basis of a knockout search because by nature, it's sort of arbitrary. There's no way you can just by looking at your own publicly available sources that you can really determine what's out there that could be, as you say, considered confusingly similar. So once you go through the knockout search and you conclude that there's at least nothing out there that's identical that would just blow us out of the water right out of the chute, you normally commission a professional trademark search, and we normally use, as you know, a firm called Thomson Reuters, which is a nationally known company that actually will search all feasible sources,
newspaper articles,
right.
all sorts of things. Yeah.
But the beauty of the professional search is they are trained and capable of searching most of the sources you'd have to look at for not just the identical mark, but anything that under their own analysis would be considered to be confusingly similar. It's hard to do that search on your own, say by looking at the U.S. Patent Trademark Office website, but you get a search and you'll report from a professional search entity, and you'll end up getting after 10 days or so after you search apply for the report, probably a 1 or 2 inch thick binder.
I've seen them.
Right.
I think I've reviewed a couple that were over 1,000 pages.
Right. But see, then that goes to your comment earlier about the Delta example, because what you have to do then is go through that report, and it can be painstaking. And you identify, well, are there any identical marks? No. Well, are there any confusingly similar marks? And if you find identical or similar marks, as you just said in the Delta example, you're not necessarily dead in the water. But then you've got to go further. You've got to look, okay, if it's an identical mark to your mark, well, what are the goods and services for the other mark? Where are they located? Are they a local business only using that mark in a certain geographical area, or are they using it nationwide? Do the markets overlap geographically? So there's a whole – and sometimes you even look at, well, okay, there was another mark that was very similar to ours in a similar marketplace, but – they allowed their registration to expire 10 years ago. Then you've got to look to see, well, did they stop using the mark or are they using it on an unregistered basis? I've actually commissioned private detectives in the past to investigate whether somebody who was using a mark is still using it, actually by going, you know, to their offices and, you know, doing searches locally and that kind of
thing. Well, another beautiful thing about those searches is it kind of gives you an indication of how strong your mark's going mm-hmm. to be. So going back to the Delta example, if you see 10 or so registered uses of Delta, mm-hmm. that means that if you want to go forward with the word Delta, there's 10 other entities out there mm-hmm. with property stakes
right.
in that space,
right.
which means you may not have as broad of rights as you would if you went with a completely different
right.
thing, even if you're not in the same goods and services. And another thing to think about too is what kind of entity has that mark? So I'm willing to bet you're probably not going to advise anybody to choose Nike in the area of that's completely unrelated to Nike's products, for example.
Right.
Just based on who they are and mm-hmm. how protective they are of their trademarks, because those trademarks are worth billions of dollars, as we said, and mm-hmm. they have a very strong interest in keeping that protected.
Mm-hmm. That's right. No, that's right. I mean, at the end of the day, evaluating a professional search report is a very subjective exercise. And to your point a minute ago about sometimes you'll find actually 10 hits that are very close on your mark. There are times when, let's say your mark is a little more descriptive than you'd like, so there's a lot of players in that vicinity for your goods and services. Sometimes you can kind of also make a negative inference that, well, if my client's okay with these other entities, you know, that are in the vicinity of your marks and or goods and services, the fact that there are numerous players that are coexisting sometimes can be used as an inference, well, one more entrant
is not
necessarily going to upset, they're not going to object. You know, now again, that's a very subjective fact determination. And you can never fully account for what the proclivities or temperament of parties on the other side might be. And you've always got to take that into account. But you end up, to some extent, you know, reading tea leaves and engaging in very subjective analyses when you look at these search reports. Because at the end of the day, what you're going to be doing for your client is, except in the most clean situations where a report is very pristine, you'll be calling out 5, 6, 10 marks and say, look, this is close. We think for this, this, and this reason, if you're ever challenged by the PTO or by the other owner, that you'd have this argument and this argument, and we'd evaluate how good the arguments are. And sometimes there's a bit of an assumption of risk. But at the end of the day, you've got to be able to, in good faith, conclude that the mark, that the client would have a legal right to use that mark and would be able to have good faith arguments for his or her position if challenged. And it's sometimes a close call. It's not always a clean process.
And that's where it just takes looking at these things for many hundreds of search reports and
right.
just kind of build up this internal knowledge
right.
almost at this point. And
when I would also
say, it's
a lot
longer than I have, Randy, but like in the
you've got the
time
same,
I did it, mm-hmm. just reviewing these search reports, you just kind of get a little bit better at it.
That's right.
And you just have kind
you
of
see
a sense.
Things.
Yeah.
Right. But the other thing is, as you know, Alex, when you get a professionally obtained search report, they search not just U.S. Patent Trademark Office registration records, but they'll search the trademark registration records of each of the 50 states. They'll search common law databases, internet domain name search engines, local directories, and they actually separate the search report by section based upon the source of the search. And part of your evaluation is, I mean, the first thing I always look at is the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office section. Are there any other former or currently registered or applied for marks that are the same or similar? Those get my attention first. But then you look at, you know, state registrations. And there you pay very much attention to it because you'll get a sense for who's out there using the mark elsewhere. But state trademark registration doesn't afford the same substantive rights as federal trademark registration. So if they don't have a federal registration, you do take that into account in the evaluation. Well, gee, if they're a one-stop small manufacturer in Poughkeepsie and your client is primarily in Wisconsin and Illinois and their mark is not federally registered, that would not necessarily be a deal killer for me. I mean, again, you look at all the factors, but you evaluate all these things to determine what the likely, you know, outcome for your client will be. And you look at all those sources.
So let's assume at this point the client comes in, they give you the name, the search mm-hmm. report comes back clean, and you give them the advice to register their marks.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the point of registering? What kind of benefits do you get from that?
Well, registration confers a number of substantive rights, as you know, and only federal registration, not state registration. But it confers constructive nationwide notice to the world of your trademark rights and a presumption that you do have the exclusive right, ownership, exclusive right to use the mark. It Registration gives you, and you're a litigator, I'm not, and this is probably more meaningful to you, but it gives you immediate access to federal courts if you're registered and you have to sue for infringement, as opposed to other types of cases where if you want to get access to federal court, so you have to, you know, abide by amount and controversy requirements and diversity requirements and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, fit within the parameters of what it takes to get into federal court.
Federal registration also provides you with a statutory right to treble damages in the event of infringement. And again, this is something that you're probably more familiar with even than I am, since I handle, you know, the prosecution of trademark applications and maintaining them. You're the guy who, you know, more likely is to go into court
when you
to enforce
trouble.
Yeah. But then, you know, the other thing that's, I think, very important to note about federal trademark registration is under the Lanham Act, which is the federal statute that governs trademarks and infringement and all of that. Under the Lanham Act, you get something called nationwide priority. And that establishes the filing date of your trademark application as your date of first use. And it establishes a nationwide priority over everyone that except someone who began using the trademark prior to your applying for your trademark. So it allows you to kind of put a stake in the ground, and except for people who already were using the same or similar mark before the date of your application, it allows you priority with respect to any later entrant on a nationwide basis. Even if your business is local, if you expand into another area of the country, your federal trademark registration
you put your stake
valuable.
In the ground, even
right.
though, and this is kind of the that intent to use application where you can put your stake in the ground prior to even using it.
Right.
Say you can't get the registration issued until you start using it.
Right.
But you can let others know that,
right.
hey, we're an up and coming business. We're
right.
starting to plan to produce these products or these mm-hmm. goods or services, and this is the mark we're going to use.
Yeah, when you're using, you've mentioned the intent to use concept, which is a very key concept in trademark registration. And it, as you said before, what confers the right to not just to common law trademark rights, but also federal registration rights is actual use in commerce. You cannot get a trademark registration without proving that you're actually using it in interstate commerce.
And that's the whole nub of trademark law, really.
That's exactly right.
You have to be using it.
Of trademark law, whether you're registered or not. The intent to use concept is a very interesting one because it's sort of, I wouldn't call it an exception to the requirement of actual use, because in all instances, you have to be using the mark to get registration. But if, let's say, you're a business and you're developing a product and you are concerned about the competitiveness of the marketplace and you want to get your stake in the ground as to a mark that you have a bona fide, and I'm using the term of art in the law, a bona fide intent to use the trademark in the near future, you can actually file a trademark application on what's called, as you said, an intent to use basis without actually using it. And that gets it in the hopper and secures your application date, okay? And what happens then is the trademark office would evaluate the application just like a normal actual use application, but rather than giving you registration, if they conclude that there's no confusingly similar marks and it's registrable and meets all the requirements, they would issue something called a notice of allowance rather than a registration certificate. And what happens then is that starts a 6-month period during which you then have to make a filing with the Patent and Trademark Office, verifying that you've begun using that mark in commerce. There are 4 6-month extensions you can get as a matter of right from the PTO, and I have extended these that many times in the past. So as a practical matter, you have a 2-year period after that notice of allowance to actually begin using that mark, you know, finish your development.
But the key throughout that is you have to have the bona fide intent to use, which is a good faith
that's right.
intent. You have to be making
you can't just have a conjectural idea.
You can't just plant your flag in the ground and come up with a plan later.
Yeah, that's right.
The plan has to be kind of formulated when you're starting
right.
to file that application.
And remember, these are sworn applications under penalty of perjury. So you can't just say, yeah, I have a bona fide intent to use this mark. You've got to actually have activities, measurable activities you're engaging in that would reasonably lead to using it in the near future. So it's a very valuable thing, because then if you get the registration after filing an intent to use application, your right extends back to your data first use extends back to the date of the application. And in that way, as you say, you stick your stake in the ground, and that can be a very potent tool in terms of securing your intellectual property rights in that mark.
Okay, so we've gotten through the search process at this point. We've decided we have a mark that we can register or at least apply for. Mm-hmm. Can we talk a little bit about the application process?
Sure.
I know after you do the search report and all that, that's where the real heavy lifting's done. And I know the application process is kind of a
right,
almost a formality at that point.
Yeah.
If you've done the search right, it should almost be a
right.
formality.
A lot of the legal art, as you say, is in the search and evaluation of the mark and making sure they pick the mark correctly, that kind of a thing. The trademark application, I mean, is actually an electronic online application. And it's a fill-in-the-blanks document, so I'm not going to, you know, it's not like a legal brief or whatever. And a lot of it is informational, information about the owner, location, date of first use of the mark in commerce, all that kind of stuff. But one of the there are a couple of key features to a trademark application, and that one of them is, and probably the key one, is describing the goods and services that are going to be denoted by that trademark. And all goods and services are classified by the Patent and Trademark Office under, I believe, 46 international classes.
Yes.
When you include services.
And the interesting thing is those are international classes.
That's
so
right.
They're the same throughout the world. So
right.
One thing we can definitely say for another day is international trademark.
Right.
Trademark applications and registration.
But right.
That is something for if you're a larger entity. Something to consider as well.
That's right. But from the standpoint of what the lawyer needs to do in the application is they need to describe those goods and services as broadly as possible to create as wide of a swath as possible of protection for the client. But it can't be any broader than the degree to which they're actually using the mark.
Yes, and that ties us back to the whole
– exactly.
You have to be using it in order to
yeah.
have it. You can't
and there's a
just trademark stuff.
That's right. And there's a little more to that than meets the eye. Oftentimes it ends up being sometimes as few as three words. Sometimes it's three paragraphs. It all depends on what the client needs, what the circumstances of the product or service are. But there's a great deal of care that lawyers put into that goods and services description. And what's more, the Patent Trademark Office is very persnickety about – some words, some of the language that you use. They don't like inclusive language, like the mark denotes
nuts.
Night clothing, including pajamas or something like that. They will not allow including because that can be just open-ended. You had an example.
Well, too. I was going to say nuts, bolts, including springs and other.
Yeah.
Small tool stuff.
The examiner in your example would probably contact you and say, well, you've got to actually list all of them,
all the parts of the products. You're using,
exactly.
Yeah.
So you do get into, those types of things, but you want to make sure that you accurately, as expansively as possible, but truthfully, not farther than is true, describe those goods and services. And then in order to verify that you're using the mark in commerce, you have to provide at least one specimen showing that mark in use in commerce. And for a product, it would be, say, a packaging showing with the mark on it, showing that it is for that type of service or good that's described in the application. And, for services, it can sometimes be brochures, advertisements, that kind of a thing. And then we get into certification marks and all of that, which are beyond the course of our discussion. Those are different kinds of specimens. But by and large, for a business, it's going to be something like that. But the application itself, at the end of the day, once you're done, is not a long, expansive document. It's sort of anticlimactic in a way.
So you'll then file the application, and then you'll wait up. Right now, processing times are 6 to 9 months. I've heard it as low. This is before my time, but I've heard it used to be around 2 to 4 months.
That would have been a long, long time ago.
But you'll file the application, and then you'll get either an office action mm-hmm. From the U.S. Trademark Office
right.
or a notice of allowance or something.
Actually, it's approved for publication
yes,
in an actual use
for
mark.
Publication.
And that usually, my experience is that you don't hear that they're even acknowledging the application for a couple of months. If there's an issue, as you say, if they have a problem that the mark is not registrable because it's descriptive or something like that, or if they think it's confusingly similar, potentially confusingly similar with another registered trademark, they'll communicate with you through what you've just described, an office action. It's a written document. You're allowed 3 months. Used to be 6 months. Now it's 3 months to respond in order to keep the application moving forward. And you've got to respond through the same portal that you applied and all of that.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but that's a non-extendable 3 month deadline.
That is not, I've never, that's true. Not extendable.
I believe it's a statutory deadline.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So you have to, if you miss that deadline, the consequences are your applications.
There are very limited exceptions for mistake, you know, like you didn't get it or something like that, and you've got a petition. Yeah.
But for the most part, that's a hard deadline.
That's right. Yeah. Typically, when I get an office action, we dock at the date immediately and we get on it. There's no point in waiting until the last minute, you know. But by and large, then, if you get over the hump with the PTO, if you convince them through this written response that their issue, they're incorrect on the issue, or there's a good argument to rebut their concern, they'll either agree with you or disagree with you. And if they agree with you, then they'll issue something called a notice of publication, which means that the application goes on to the next step in the application process and is published in an official PTO newspaper called the Official Gazette. And then
I believe that comes out every Monday or Tuesday.
Yeah. It's not very compelling reading, is it, Alex?
It's pretty dull, let's put it that way. I think it's thousands of, or hundreds of pages right. of just trademarks right. and their goods and services.
But that's sort of the notice to the world that the PTO has said, we think this mark is registrable. It's been applied for and it will go to registration unless somebody objects within 30 days of that publication date.
Yeah, and that's kind of
the whole 30 days and right.
The whole purpose of that upfront search is to kind of avoid that.
That's right.
What would not be so great is to file an application, go through the expensive process of getting an office action, which depending on the time can take several hours to respond of an attorney's time, only to find out that there is a pre-existing registered mark or something like that would knock you out. And in terms of the notice of publication, that's more directed at letting other entities know they think this mark's, and not to repeat you, but this mark's going to go forward unless right. somebody says stop.
That's right.
And that search report can help you identify who those people are.
That's right.
So
that's right.
The example that I'm thinking of is if you tried to get, I don't want to keep using Nike, but that's the one that comes to mind, which is if you wanted to get Nike, for example, in electrical services, you could maybe make an argument if you could get past like mm-hmm. the famous mark part of it that there's no other Nike registration for like electrical services.
That's right.
But I can guarantee you the moment that was published, you'd have a letter from Nike saying you can't
right.
do that. They're going to use everything in their power to stop that mark from issuing.
That's right. Well, and you raise a really important point because when we talk about evaluating trademarks and the subjective nature of it, one of the things I always take into account is the economic wherewithal and the, as I say, the temperament of the other side. And I think that the more money that the other side has to its disposal and the more famous its mark is, the more aggressive they're going to be to cut over as wide of a swath of protection for themselves as possible. I always bring out the example of, like the mom and pop daycare up in Ladysmith, Wisconsin, that wants to put an unlicensed image of Mickey Mouse on the wall of their daycare, and they get a cease and desist letter from Disney 3 days later. And I mean, those kinds of things happen because Disney has so much invested, and they're so wealthy and so much invested in their intellectual property that they will go to great, unreasonably extensive lengths to essentially intimidate others away from even thinking about messing with their intellectual property. So they'll actually go to that extreme, I think. I'm using Disney totally as an example. I have no personal experience with that entity, with that business in doing this, but I'm just using them as an example of a famous mark. You could interject
and substitute a number of famous marks.
Exactly. Yeah. But you do need to take that into account, because oftentimes your client is, you know, it's a closely held business. And, you know, I've found that the more powerful the owner on the other side, the more you have to take into account the possibility that even if they're acting unreasonably, they may go after you, even if they have a thin reed of a legal argument, because they think they can just
they'll just outspend you basically. Right. So
you got to take those things into account.
Yes, yeah. So like a smaller business, they may be in the right, but like, again, to take your example of Disney, Disney will not hesitate to spend thousands of dollars to just make sure that their space is protected, even if they are going a little bit outside of their space.
Right.
You can obviously push back, but it's going to be an expensive fight to push back.
Right. That's exactly right. If you have to spend six figures of legal fees to prevail, that can feel an awful lot like losing sometimes, even if you prevail on the merits.
All right. So if nobody objects during the or if, I think the term is if nobody opposes the mark during the notice of publication, you'll get a notice of allowance. And then
you'll get a confirmation that nobody's objected. And a notice that it's going to move on
to the notice of allowance,
registration, right?
And then after that, you'll get a registration issue.
That's right.
If you're not using the mark and it's an intent to use act, we talked a little bit about this. You'll get the notice of allowance, but then you'll have
the 6 month period.
To show evidence of use. Use in commerce.
Yep. Exactly. And it's called a notice of use, something like that. And, you know, again, it's another form on they're all forms in the online USPTO portal, so that you fit within the rubric of their normal conventions. But yes, you make a filing after that notice of allowance and intent to use application within the time frame. Usually it's 6 months. And you got to provide a specimen showing evidence of use. And then it goes through the same process, publication. And if it gets through that process, registration usually issues. The process takes a good, better part of a year under the best of circumstances, though. And if you have one or two passes with the PTO on an office action, it can take more than a year.
So let's talk a little bit about, once the registration is issued, then now you have your rights, and you have those rights so long as you continue to maintain the registration, which you have a five-year filing, and then usually you only have to file a renewal every 10 years and that'll last until you either one, stop using the mark, or two, decide no longer to register. And the one thing to keep in mind here is that there are unregistered trademarks, which we talked a little bit just about at the beginning, and then we have these registered trademarks, and that's kind of where the focus of our time has been. And one of the reasons we wanted to talk about registered trademarks was because of one of the benefits they give you is this nationwide notice. And that allows you to kind of have a presumptive claim of validity if you come across somebody who's essentially using your trademark.
That's right.
So that's kind of what we would call trademark infringement. And kind of the couple of things to keep in mind with trademark infringement are, one, how similar is the mark, the infringer's mark to yours? Two, how similar are their goods to yours?
Right.
And those are kind of the two biggest factors.
Yeah. Isn't it fair to say, Alex, that the test for infringement is not dissimilar from the same analysis we go through when we're evaluating the availability of a mark against other potentially confusing marks?
That's exactly it. Mm-hmm. So at the front end, you want to make sure you're not the one infringing.
Right.
And that's what that search is designed to kind of cover and make sure, hey, is this a good space to be in?
Right.
And on the back end, you're going to try to look for people who didn't do that due diligence. And you're going to hope to basically cut them off from using your mark and diluting it, decreasing the value of that mark. What you just mentioned was we do the searching on the front end to kind of protect ourselves from being the infringer. Mm-hmm. On the back end, we can do that same analysis, the similarity of the mark and the similarity of the goods. And there's a bunch of other factors as well that we won't talk about today, but those are kind of the two prevailing ones that courts look at. And we can use those to kind of inform our analysis of whether or not somebody is infringing on our marks.
Right.
And if we find that they are, that gives us, because we have this federal registration, that gives us access to the federal courts, gives us a presumption of validity, gives us a presumption of that this is a validly registered trademark and all the goodwill that comes along with that. So that's
Right.
Kind of the whole purpose of this process
That's
is
right.
to, it sounds like a very tedious nuts and bolts, why am I doing this? Mm-hmm. But that is, it allows you to incur a property right that you get to assert against others. And that's kind of the big takeaway from
and
all
of
this.
Registered and if you're registered, and the causes of action that you're describing for infringement can be found in numerous statutes, both state and federal and state, but primarily infringement arises under the Lanham Act, which I mentioned earlier. And under the Lanham Act, we talked about the benefits of having registration if you have to sue for infringement, and you get immediate access, as we said earlier, to the federal court to file your suit for infringement. You can allege treble damages in your complaint by virtue of your registered mark, and you have the bump procedurally of not having to prove that you're using the mark, but the registration can serve as prima facie evidence and all of that. The other thing that's worth mentioning, because it's useful in the infringement context, is you mentioned once the registration issues, you talked about it being a 10-year term, which it has to be renewed every 10 years. And you also mentioned, Alex, that in the first 10-year term, in order to keep the registration going to the end of the 10-year term, you have to make a filing between the fifth and sixth year of registration, and it's mandatory that that filing be a declaration of what's called continued use. Are you still using the mark? But you can, on an optional basis, and if the mark is eligible, I always do this, you can file a dual declaration at that time, not just of continued use, but also a declaration to make the mark incontestable, which creates the numerous presumptions that you get by virtue of federal registration become conclusive evidence.
Yeah, and a statement
and
of incontestability.
Procedurally, that helps you going into court.
Yeah, and a statement of incontestability is just during that first 5 years of that trademark's life, nobody's challenged it.
Right.
I've not seen any notice of that.
Right.
And you just sign an affidavit to that effect. Mm-hmm. So I think that's what we should cover for today, Randy. I know it's been quite a lot, and we still have quite a bit more to go through. It's a very complicated area of law, a lot of statutes to deal with, a lot of cases to kind of inform this whole understanding. But I think the two or three big takeaways are: trademarks are an extremely valuable thing, and it's important to get it right from the outset.
Correct.
By getting it right at the outset, you can avoid being the infringer, and you can avoid other people from later coming onto your space if you kind of know who's out there already.
I guess another way to say it is you want to play really good defense at the outset. Be defensive in terms of making sure you're not stepping on anybody else's toes by doing your due diligence so that you can play offense once you have your registration and assert your rights.
That's a very good way to put it, Randy. Well, thank you so much for listening to this month's MTFN's BizCast. We hope you enjoyed the presentation, and we'll join us next time for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to this MTFN BizCast. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access other podcast episodes, articles, and the contact information for our attorneys. To keep up to date with Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols, you can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.